This is the time set for argument in case number 84334, Franklin versus Franklin. And counsel, who'll be arguing today?
We are going to be sharing the argument.
Okay.
I'm going to do 5 minutes. She's going to do 6 minutes, and then I'm going to reserve 4 minutes on rebuttal.
Okay, great. Okay. Good afternoon. All right, why don't you come on up? You may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Emily McFarling for appellant. I'm here with co-counsel Ashley Vasquez as well. She was trial counsel, so the questions that you have that are more fact-specific are best directed at her if they come up when I'm arguing. In the notice, it specifically detailed a question on whether or not appellant had met her burden by clear and convincing evidence that her ex-husband had engaged in domestic violence against her, sufficient to invoke the presumption that joint physical custody was not in the best interest of the children. And in this case, we have a lot of discussion by the district court judge about the domestic violence evidence that came in, and we have a lot of domestic violence evidence that was not admitted in as well. But the big problem in this case is that while the district court says the right buzzwords for what legal standard she's using, you know, she sets a clear and convincing standard to rebut the presumption against joint physical custody. We have the best interest factors that have a preponderance of the evidence standard when you're reviewing domestic violence in that context. And so, you know, she gives lip service to that. But when you actually review the evidence that is in the record and her, you know, how she views the credibility of the parties as well, not just looking at faulting her for the findings being error. It's very clear that there is absolutely clear and convincing evidence of domestic violence in this case. I mean, if this case doesn't rise to that level, I don't know what needs to meet that burden in order to invoke this presumption in a child custody case. I mean, one step above that is somebody getting murdered. I mean, there's not, you know, there's the range of 7.5 years of constant physical abuse and control is not so far off from anything that we would absolutely want to invoke this presumption.
Well, Ms. McFarlane, I guess let me follow up on that. You know, obviously I've been thinking a lot about this case. I did before and certainly in preparation for argument. But she testified about these domestic violence and John testified none of that happened, right?
Correct.
Basically. And so if she's the trial judge evaluating credibility, can't she make the determination what she believes about that?
Yes, and here's why this case is important, and I think one that is good for review by you. That when you know, there are cases where people make up domestic violence, and a judge can go in and say, I think that this person is lying and that they are not actually a victim of domestic violence. That happens, and that's absolutely the trial judge's authority, discretion to be able to find that. That's not really what happened in this case. In this case, we see the district court jumping through hoops to find that the evidence that did come in did not meet the legal standard, and I think using an incorrect legal standard, and in excluding the corroborating evidence. We have in Nevada law, in criminal cases of domestic violence, the victim's testimony alone is sufficient for a criminal standard, right? This is a lower standard than that. And in this, we have her commentary, the judge's commentary about why she's not finding full credibility and finding absolutely there's domestic violence to meet that standard is because of things like there weren't witnesses to the actual incidents of domestic violence. She didn't bring in medical records. Some of the photos that she had of her injuries, she couldn't remember exactly when they happened because there were so many of them. Right? There are so many she can't remember when they happened, and so they weren't admitted into evidence. That's a big problem. And so this isn't a case where the judge said, no, I don't believe this person, it's fake. That's not what happened here. And I think that how she applied the legal standard to the facts that she did find is a clear error. It's plain error. It's not us coming here asking you to say, oh, her findings are wrong. We do have a few errors in it. There's one point where she says, oh, there's inconsistent testimony between like a TPO application and a police report, and it's really clear on its face she's comparing two different incidents, documents from two different incidents, so the finding on that actually is error, and that went to the credibility. But the number of witnesses that were involved in the aftermath of these incidents, the number of witnesses to the control behaviors that happened, and even the findings that were made about the control behaviors and this man's demeanor on the witness stand and his interactions with the judge during the trial. I mean, there's so much evidence of domestic violence in this case that it just, you can't get to a point where you say, well, she found that there wasn't.
Okay. Thank you.
Am I at my time?
It's up to you, but you're down to 9:19.
Okay. I'll hand off.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Ashley Vasquez, also co-counsel for appellant. May it please the court. Kind of piggybacking off of my co-counsel about the DV standard, and there is actual case law, too, about the clear and convincing can for domestic battery can be met alone by a victim testimony. And I think the district court judge said that quite a bit, and she was very clear in even one of the witnesses' testimony where she was testifying to some things that Ashley was telling her after the events that she said, you are not going to prove by clear and convincing evidence unless you give me a firsthand witness. That's just not realistic. Abusers are not abusing their victims in front of people. She did testify as to things she saw. She saw John hitting a hole in the wall. She saw Ashley flying across the couch and hitting her head on the wall. She had another friend who had testified that she had been confided in about some abuse. Even her mother and her stepfather admitted that she had confided in them during their marriage to the domestic violence. The TPO applications, there were two TPOs were granted in 2013. She testified how he violated those TPOs. She also testified how she just stopped calling the police eventually because they weren't doing anything for her. And she testified in detail, which I think is important to this case law, that even the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, as long as the victim testifies with particularity as to the events, then that's sufficient. And she was
very particular.
Can be sufficient.
It's not like it doesn't mandate, like if someone testifies domestic violence happened, that the court must find that it happened.
Correct. And so what Ms. McFarlane was talking about, the evidence that we were trying to get in would be like the CAD reports. You know, the district court judge said that she believes that there are acts of domestic violence, but she doesn't believe that it rises to the level of clear and convincing.
But CAD reports, though, were not authenticated, right?
They were not. But the fact that the district court found that she was exaggerating, those reports would have corroborated her testimony that she called the police X amount of times. It would have at least backed up what she was saying, and she could have been found more credible. Same thing with the photos. She testified that she got black eyes. The photo being excluded just would have shown that she was telling the truth, that she has had a black eye before. And so the lack of the physical evidence that she's saying what was needed, that there needed to be firsthand eyewitnesses, that is not required for the clear and convincing standard.
Do I have in the record on appeal the photos that were offered but not admitted?
The photo... I reviewed the record. We did not include that photo, but we cited to the transcript where we talk about it and the CAD reports as well. The thing my client was testifying to, she couldn't remember the specific date, but she could narrow it down to a period. And she recognized that period. She took the photo and she recognized it because it was right before her eyebrows were tattooed. So she knew exactly what time frame it was, but could not give an exact date. And that is why the district court did not let it in, because she didn't have a date. The other issue that is really, really big in the district court judge even asked in closing arguments, if I find DV by clear and convincing evidence, how does he rebut it? There's no guidance in Nevada law on how to rebut the presumption once it's invoked. We think that the presumption is invoked just because she found acts of domestic violence. That's what it says. Acts of domestic violence happened. I'm finding that it happened. I don't know what extent it happened to, but she is a victim. She says that she believes she's a victim. She testified like a victim. She really believed that she was a victim, but didn't give findings as to, like, on this date, John punched her in the face, essentially. We think there's been enough presented to invoke the presumption, but she said in the closing arguments, the judge was like, how does he rebut it? There's no guidance. I had suggested in the underlying proceedings, the California actually has 6 factors on how to rebut this presumption. There's 6 factors listed. And I gave that to the judge because I thought that was the closest thing that we had.
That's from a California statute, right?
Correct. And I thought it was persuasive. I thought it gave the judge something to say, like, if he met these factors, then he rebuts it. Invoking the presumption doesn't mean he could never have joint. He has an opportunity to rebut it. And I think there should be some analysis that Nevada courts have that gives them guidance as to how to do that.
And I want to ask about one slightly different topic briefly, okay. And that is that as to the attorney's fees that she signed a note for to the friend who helped her out with that, okay?
Yeah.
And the court in the divorce order, the decree, ended up finding that she wasn't going to award them and felt the standard hadn't been met at that time to warrant them being considered a community debt. But she did suggest that there could be a subsequent motion filed for fees. Was a subsequent motion filed?
Yes, there was a post-judgment motion filed, and the judge reserved ruling on it until this case was decided. But yes, that was an issue, and I don't know if that goes hand in hand. I don't think the district court was clear. The promissory note in of itself is a bona fide debt, no matter how it was spent. Obviously, if it gets divided and somebody gets awarded fees, that would offset things. But
so she didn't rule on the motion for fees pending the appeal?
This decision, yeah. It's been deferred. I'm going to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Moore?
Yes.
If it's easier, you can argue from there. I don't object, but it's up to you. I notice you have the walker over there, so whatever works for you.
Yeah, it's just like a little device to help.
Okay, sure.
Thanks. Uh-huh. It's been a rough month.
Okay. I'm glad you made it.
Thank you. Me too. Okay. May it please the court. I don't know where the court wants me to begin. However, I do have some rebuttal to counsel's statements or assertions regarding the DV. I think it's notable that this trial spanned the course of 7 days. That's a long time. And during that time, Judge Mastin had an opportunity to observe the witnesses for the plaintiff and the defendant, their behaviors, their reactions, and things of that nature. And that's why we have specific case law on the trier of fact is very well suited. They're there. It's like somebody saying, describing a car accident, and you just don't get the flavor that you would if you weren't there. And so there's a reason why we have that fundamental case law. I think it's also notable that Judge Mastin is experienced, and she's got 6 years as a DV hearing master. A DV hearing master, and she's heard over 3,000 cases of DV. So I think that's very notable, too. And I think just as a...
Mark, I was a little concerned,
sure,
because In certain places in the order, Judge Mastin made findings that domestic violence had occurred, and in fact she found it by a preponderance of the evidence, but not by clear and convincing. And on page 33, she describes that as the extremely high burden of proof. And I'm concerned about that characteristic. Would you agree that clear and convincing is an extremely high burden of proof?
No. And it sounds counterintuitive, and perhaps I was going to segue into this. And unfortunately, in the domestic family law arena, we are seeing, at least I am, more and more of false assertions, not just in the DV realm, but also in sexual misconduct. With that being said, and I looked at NRS 125C003 and prior to this hearing, and 125C.0035. And the way I read it, and perhaps the court's going to clarify this, I don't know. Hopefully, if you deem that it needs clarified, is factor 4K, whether either parent or other person seeking physical custody has engaged in an act of domestic violence against the child, a parent of the child, or any other person residing with the child. And if the court recalls, Judge Mastin did find that particular factor in favor of Ashley, but she weighed it, and that's why we have the other factors to weigh the DV, weigh maybe the factor for abduction, weigh the factor if one party is keeping the child from another. That's substantial too. So I think if you find that it's clear and convincing, I think looking at everything cumulatively, I don't think the clear and convincing is such a harsh standard. And that might sound like it's counterintuitive coming from me as a woman, but as a practitioner and seeing what I see, the reality is that if you loosen the standard, you lower it to maybe a preponderance of evidence, it's going to be opening that Pandora's box. There's a reason why, and by way of analogy, in criminal law, we have beyond a reasonable doubt. Why do we have such a high standard? Because somebody's freedom, it's at risk. Wow, that there's their freedom, their liberty. And so the standard here, a parent's fundamental right to their children, this is a child, this is a parent, trying to have that child in their life, a child at stake.
Ms. Morrow, so let's talk about clear and convincing and what that means in practical effect when you're trying to meet the standard as a party. So the court, does there have to be clear and convincing evidence that on a specific day and time there was domestic violence to meet that standard? Or can, if she finds clear and convincing evidence that at some point during this relationship there was domestic violence, is that enough to meet it?
That's a great question. I think the clear, because, and that's the difficulty in being a practitioner in family law, is I could go in one courtroom, get one result, go somewhere else, get another result. But I think the clear and convincing standard as it is, there are so many safeguards contained within NRS 125C.0035 that the court weighs, irrespective of the domestic violence. I think that the court looks at it cumulatively. And in this case, there just wasn't, for example, If something happens to me and it's catastrophic, I remember it, as most people do. But in this case, there were basic questions that were unable to be answered, and there wasn't any specificity. And so the court looked at that. And again, I'm getting back to the court. I mean, who is in any better position to make these decisions than somebody that's presiding over that trial. I mean, she sat for days, seven days.
What about the fact that a court had reviewed this case at some point, or this domestic violence situation at some point, and felt it was appropriate to grant an extended temporary protective order?
Yes. Well, the TPO, and again, as a practitioner, and I think a lot of times our law obviously is based on societal occurrences, what's happening in our society at the time. And it's better safe than sorry. So I think if the court, and I can't speak for the DV hearing masters, but if they're going to err on the side of caution, they're going to do it to protect somebody, absolutely. I think it's notable in that regard, since you brought it up, I think it's notable that that TPO was not extended. As a matter of fact, she didn't even, if my memory serves me correctly, she didn't even show at one of the hearings.
Well, and, one was and one was not.
Right. Okay. So the one that wasn't, she didn't even show at that one. And so
that's not unusual in domestic violence cases, in my experience. Is, I don't know about yours, but...
I think if somebody, in my experience, if somebody is really afraid, they're going to show up, they're going to use all resources available. And every case is different. It's, I always tell clients, your case is like your fingerprint. It's never going to be like that one or this one. But as far as a standard, as I said, I don't think I can stress that enough. If you're going to factor in a clear and convincing standard into the 125C.0035-4K, that's going, it's going to be difficult. That proverbial Pandora's box will be opened. As perhaps maybe what constitutes clear and convincing evidence is the better route to go. Because I think that will you can find that there's DV in 4K. And if you do, then you look to 5 and say, what is that standard for clear and convincing evidence? What are some examples? And then go the step beyond. But in this case, you don't get to 5 because it's, and I want to be clear. I was present at the trial, obviously, but the judge, she was, when she said, you're not going to get there, it's almost as if she was saying, give me something I can hang my hat on. I want a witness that actually saw it or observed it, or, you know, not after the fact, not hearsay.
Is that required?
I'm sorry?
Is that required?
No, absolutely not. No. But she wanted something. She wanted something more than what she had. She wanted tools to work with so that she could find out what to, you know, what determined what is in the best interest of these children. And she just didn't. And interestingly enough, she said, more likely than not, yes. And this factor favors Ashley. Absolutely, she said that in the decree. But there were other factors that did not. Unfortunately, we don't, you know, people can't be put into boxes like that, like you're a DV offender, and so no children for you. We have to look at mom, too, and mom has some serious drug issues. She left the children,
even if the court found, if the court had found clear and convincing evidence and applied the presumption, it still would have been a rebuttable presumption, and the court still could have ended up ordering joint custody, right?
Absolutely. Yes, that's the beauty of family law. And I shouldn't make light of that, but because it is such a fundamental right for a parent.
Right.
And so that's why we have these different subsets that we weigh, and the judges really take their time because we're dealing with children. That's been my experience, and I was there at the trial. Judge Mastin did not take her duties lightly, and I think it speaks volumes. I think the decree is 44 pages long, which isn't typical down in family
court. I'm sorry, but can you briefly address, before your time runs out,
sure,
the attorney fee debt issue?
Yes, absolutely. If the court recalls, there were interveners in this case as well, and there was never any definition. Sorry, there was never any definition as to how those fees were split up. I don't know if the court wants me to address the JPI, but I did want to say one thing, just to clarify the record. There was an assertion that the parenting agreement did not order joint physical custody. In my opinion, it did. John had every Friday morning until Monday afternoon, and under Bluestein, in my book, that is joint physical custody. So I wanted to make that clear for the court, because I would never make a misrepresentation.
Okay. During the marriage, Ashley signed a promissory note to this other friend who had put out money to help pay her attorney's fees during the pendency of the case, so that's still during the marriage. Why is that amount not a community debt?
Karen Brady, because it violated the JPI. There was never any proof brought forth as to how she spent $69,000 and I don't have the and change in within a 14-month period when she's receiving child support, she's receiving food stamps, she's working part-time for Karen Brady, and she's receiving $12.
How does it violate the JPI to find a source of money to pay her attorneys to litigate her divorce case?
Oh, to litigate her divorce case?
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay. Fees. I'm sorry. I thought we were talking about the $69,000. My read of the EDCR for the JPI is that she has to, once the proceedings commence, that she has to obtain approval for that. And again, those attorney's fees, it was never definitive as to what was spent defending against the interveners. Because there was some litigation there. As a matter of fact, it even went up on appeal, as this court knows. And
but
so,
would it not still be a community debt incurred during the marriage?
That's interesting, because my client would submit, and my client did not participate in that, but my client would submit that it shouldn't be a community debt, because he had no qualms with the grandparents seeing the children as Ashley did.
Do you, counsel told me when I asked her on the other side here that they did file a then post-trial motion for fees, but that the district court has sort of held that pending the outcome of the appeal. Is that your recollection of the status on that?
It is. It is.
Okay. So you agree that that's what happened?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Could you please comment on the fees awarded in connection with the motion to reconsider?
Yes. I can comment on that. I was prepared to argue that, and Judge Mastin said, nope, I've made my decision. I've reviewed the pleadings, and she felt that the motion for reconsideration was meritless, and so there wasn't a lot of argument on that, and the fees were warranted in that instance. Absolutely, it was appropriate.
Did she find that the motion was... I'm going to extend it a little bit.
Oh, thank you.
Did she find that the motion was frivolous or otherwise met 18.010 standard?
I can't recall, Your Honor. You got me.
Okay.
Justice Kadish, that is the one thing I did not look at. I was consumed with the DV, but...
Okay. We did say to focus on that.
Okay, yes. And my recollection in, I don't know, perhaps counsel can answer that, but my recollection from the tone of her voice and the way she didn't let me argue, it was, she felt that it was not... didn't have merit.
Okay, hang on. Just did you have another question?
I don't.
You wanted it. Okay. All right. Thank you, Ms. Marr.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Rebuttal. Okay.
You asked Ms. Marr earlier if there needs to be a finding of a specific incident of domestic violence to meet the clear and convincing standard, or a finding that at some point it happened was sufficient. And I think this case is kind of a good example of the distinction between those two concepts when a district court judge is tasked with finding domestic violence. I mean, you have cases where there's one incident, it's clear, we're going to go through the exact details of this one incident or two incidents, but here we have a case of 7.5 years of constant abuse. And in a case like this where, and I mean, this case went on for several years too. It was initiated in 2019. And so the ability to recall specifics, I mean, I think it's even noted in the decision that victims of domestic violence often have difficulty recalling. They have difficulty with specifics. You know, it's something that is a major problem if you're going to hold a victim to the standard of having to recall exact specifics of every incident or multiple incidents from 7.5 years of consistent abuse, too. You know, the standard, if it is set at that high, is insurmountable. And so in this case, I think it's very clear that we have a long pattern throughout an entire relationship, beginning even before the marriage. And I can't think of a better example of a classic domestic violence case as this one, and the amount of evidence that went into the record to that effect, with John merely saying, no, it didn't happen, not giving specific details that gives any credibility to him denying it. It's just very clear. And in Nevada, we don't have any case law on how the district court needs to look at how high this bar is set in order to find domestic violence by clear and convincing evidence and invoke this presumption. It would be really great if this court could give some guidance to our district court judges on just where that line is, because I think it's not just this case. It's set really high. The amount of times that this presumption is invoked in custody cases where we have somebody coming in saying there was domestic violence, it's unfortunate how often these kinds of loopholes to get out of making that finding are in place by the district court. And if there was some guidance that said, you know, testimony alone by the victim can be sufficient if it's believed, you know, that, and you know, that would be really great to have that. And I think in this case we have enough evidence that it's not about the judge having not found she was credible or not found domestic violence. It's about her legal standard and how she views her job and the bar that's set.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. This matter will stand submitted. We'll be in recess until our next argument tomorrow.